think we'll make a start and people can continue to come in if they're still arriving. It's really my pleasure as Deputy Director of LSE Health and as co-editor of Globalisation and Health to be able to welcome you to the lecture this evening. We're hoping the journal Globalisation and Health is one of the Biomed Central online open access journals, but it's affiliated with LSE Health. So we're hoping that this will be the first of several events that we can run jointly and support in that way. And I feel particularly lucky that we've managed to get Marcia Hinhorn to come this evening, because it's for those of you who have been here at the symposium today looking at health systems, health economies and globalisation, it just seemed fantastic that she could come in and add to the symposium during the day. And I'm even more thrilled when I asked Marcia when we were making the organisations, the volcano was still erupting, and I knew she had to get to Norway first and then get here, and just crossing her fingers that it worked, and luckily it has. So I think really I just like to welcome Marcia, and her bio I think was available on the invitation and email that most people will have received, and it's extremely extensive. But Marcia's the William K. Lamman Professor of Anthropology and International Affairs in the Department of Anthropology and the Betty McMillan Centre for International and Area Studies at Yale. She's also the Chair of the Council of Middle East Studies. And I don't know how many of you know her work well, but she's a specialist on Middle Eastern gender and health issues, conducting research over the last 20 years around the social impact of infertility and assisted reproductive technologies in Egypt, Lebanon, United Arab Emirates. Her bio lists a whole list of books that she's authored, 3 books, edited and co-edited and many more. And I just always love the title Globalisation and Gametes, and I've had the pleasure of hearing Marcia before, probably about a year or so ago when she was over in Cambridge. So I'm very pleased that she can come and talk this evening. She's going to talk for about 45, 50 minutes, and then it's open to everybody for a discussion. Thanks, Marcia.
Well, first I have to thank Emma for tracking me down in the middle of a travel. There were other places that I was this week, and in fact, in Norway, they're having a workshop on the very same theme of globalization and global health, and it's a theme that I think is becoming more and more important in the new millennium, and so I'm really happy to be here with all of you and to see friends from places that I was earlier this year, particularly India, where there was a wonderful conference put together by Sarojini and her colleagues at SENA on assisted reproductive technologies and globalization and the impact in the country of India. So it's like our worlds come together in interesting ways. I think my theme tonight and what I'm going to be talking about probably is a bit of a presage or prologue to tomorrow's discussion of transnationalism in healthcare and some of the global outsourcing that's being done, especially as it affects women's bodies and women's health, including in India. And the topic is globalization and gametes, where I'm going to be looking at reproductive tourism and what that means. And then I'll move you into an ethnographic case study that I've been working on for quite some time in the Middle East. So just to give you a bit of background, in January 2007, about 3 years ago, I began a new study which was called Globalization and Reproductive Tourism in the Arab World. And the main question of that study is what motivates the global movements of infertile people searching for assisted reproductive technologies and human gametes, donor sperm, donor egg, donor embryo, and surrogacy. And inspired by recent developments in globalization theory, medical anthropology, gender studies, and science and technology studies, my work now focuses on this newly defined phenomenon known as reproductive tourism, which to define it has been called the traveling by candidate service recipients from one institution, jurisdiction, or country where treatment is not available to another institution, jurisdiction, or country where they can obtain the kind of medically assisted reproduction they desire. As such, it is part of the more general medical tourism. And I must say that Guido Pennings, who's the colleague of one of the people here in the audience in Belgium, has been the main philosopher, bioethicist, scholar, writing and defining what this phenomenon is. It's been recognized since the new millennium. But little is known about the motivations of reproductive tourists in any part of the world. There was a front page story in the New York Times in 2005 entitled "Fertility Tourists Go Great Lengths to Conceive," which claimed that infertile Americans were seeking services abroad in places like South Africa, Israel, Italy, Germany, and Canada, where the costs could be much lower. However, economic factors may not be the sole consideration. Scholars who are beginning to theorize the relationship between nation states, reproductive tourism, and what are being called global reproductive rights suggest that the causes of transnational movements of infertile people could be many. There may be many different reasons. And so in the scholarly literature, seven discrete but we might call interrelated factors promoting reproductive tourism have been cited. And they include, first, that individual countries may prohibit a specific service for religious or ethical reasons, and these religious or ethical reasons could actually be converted into legal reasons. And this is what we're seeing increasingly, is that the church basically is affecting the legal status in countries like Italy. Secondly, a specific service may be unavailable because of lack of equipment or expertise, the physicians to carry out or embryologists to carry out a service, or the lack of donor gametes, and we'll say more about that. A specific service may be unavailable because it's not considered to be sufficiently safe, or its risks are unknown. And this is a consideration in countries like the United States, where we have a FDA. We do have a regulatory system where drugs and other technologies have to be approved. Oops. Certain categories of individuals may not receive a specific service on the basis of age, marital status, or sexual orientation. And so the big question is about whether homosexual couples should be entitled to assisted reproductive technologies, as well as single women. If you're not married, should you get the services? Services operate on a market or quasi-market basis, thereby affecting affordability and supply. This is a market, there's supply, there's demand, and there are often inconsistencies between the two ends. Services may simply be cheaper in other countries, and this is the one that keeps getting reiterated, this economic. Although I would say that there's more than economics in this particular phenomenon. And then finally, privacy concerns may lead individuals who want anonymity to move from their home country to another for the purposes of secrecy. Now, these seven causes of reproductive tourism are basically speculative, as little empirical research has yet to be undertaken. Yet even in the absence of empirical data, a policy debate is growing around the world about the desirability of having either national or international regulation to control the movements or to restrict the movements of reproductive tourists. And as Guido Pennings has noted, the more widespread this phenomenon, the louder the call for international measures to stop these movements. And in fact, this is what we discussed in Italy. The first leg of my journey was in Italy, where the World Assisted Reproductive Conference was being held in Rome. And there's been a lot of discussion, especially in the EU, about attempts to legally harmonize the rules between the EU countries to try to stop the movement of people across the European, across the continent. Now, most of the literature on reproductive tourism focuses on the West, and particularly upon the border crossing that's happening between the EU nations. So relatively little is known about reproductive tourism outside of Euro-America, or about the forces that motivate infertile people to undertake international travel in their quest for conception. Only through in-depth ethnographic analysis of the actual stories, desires, and migratory pathways of reproductive tourists themselves may we begin to shed light on the complex calculus of factors governing this global movement of reproductive actors. And this is actually a famous picture taken from the internet about young women in India being prepared as gestational surrogates for wealthy Western couples, for the most part, to come to India to create their test tube babies, but to have a gestational surrogate carry the fetus. So today I'd like to examine the theoretical interplay between forces of globalization and reproductive tourism in the Middle Eastern region to take us away from India. But I'm going to begin with an Indian theorist, Arjuna Padurai, who I still find his thinking on globalization to be very interesting, very useful and relevant in my own thinking about the kind of global landscape in which assisted reproductive technologies, or ARTs, as I'm going to call them for short, are being deployed and circulating around the world. But I would argue that Padurai's work needs to be engendered and expanded to include the complex, what I'm calling the reproscape, in which multiple flows of reproductive actors and reproductive technologies and finance and so on is occurring. And so I'm going to talk about something called the global reproscape. I would argue that issues of bodily commodification are paramount, given that reproductive tourism may be undertaken explicitly to procure human gametes, both sperm and eggs, and when they're put together as embryos, as well as wombs, which are increasingly being disassociated from men's and women's bodies and increasingly sold on the open market. And then in the second half of the talk, I want to turn to my own empirical work on reproductive tourism in the Middle East based on ethnographic research that I've been carrying out there since the 1980s, but particularly since the year 2003. As I am going to argue, reproductive tourism in the Middle East is inflected by local moral attitudes towards science, technology, and medicine, and particularly varying Islamic bioethical approaches to the donation of human gametes. Furthermore, the implication of gamete donation for marriage, kinship, and gender relations are tremendous, and perhaps especially for infertile Muslim couples, including those in India, where you have a very large, a very sizable Muslim population. So that's what I'd like to talk about in the second half. But before we go there, I'd like to situate the topic of reproductive tourism and this search for human gametes within the broader theoretical literature on globalization. So globalization and reproductive tourism. I'm sure you've already talked about this today, but there are so many definitions of globalization that are being circulated. There are probably about 50 to 100 books in the scholarly literature that have globalization in the title, where authors are trying to define what globalization is. And I can say that my own discipline of anthropology has been right in there, trying to say what globalization is. And this is just a very basic definition from a book that was published in 2004, that globalization is the ever faster and ever denser streams of people, images, consumer goods, money markets, and communication networks around the world. Anthropologists, I think, have been especially contributory in terms of looking at the local in the global, trying to understand the effects of globalization on the local level. And so we have a lot of books, including my own. My last book was called Local Babies, Global Science. And that's a sort of theme that we've been playing with. But sometimes anthropologists call this the glocal, combining the global in the local. So because we work at do field work in local sites, there's been a lot of interest at what happens when people accommodate global things into their environments. Now, one of the major theorists in anthropology is Arjuna Padurai, who's delineated what he calls a global cultural economy in which global movements operate through five pathways, which he famously called scapes. According to Padurai, globalization is characterized by the movement of people, which he called ethnoscapes, the movement of technology, which he called technoscapes, the movement of money, which he called financescapes, the movement of images, which he called mediascapes, and the movement of ideas, big ideas, which he called ideascapes. And he argued that these things are flowing now increasingly through very complex trajectories, and they're moving at different speeds across the globe. We sometimes talk about time-space compression, the fact that, you know, things that start out in Belgium are now rapidly moving to Malaysia. You know, so that there's a very rapid deployment now of technology, especially because of the global internet and so forth. Apaterai reminds us that this transnational movement of people's goods, money and ideas and so on is both a deeply historical and an inherently localizing process. In other words, globalization is not enacted in a uniform manner around the world, nor is it simply culturally homogenizing in its effects. People on the receiving end of global transfers, you know, don't operate in a kind of cultural vacuum. They accommodate, they sometimes incorporate, they sometimes resist the global movements and turn them into hybrid and very interesting forms. Now, the phenomenon of reproductive tourism clearly involves two of Apaterai's five scapes, namely ethnoscapes and technoscapes. And ethnoscapes he defined as the landscape of persons who constitute the shifting world in which we live: tourists, immigrants, refugees, exiles, guest workers, and other moving groups and individuals. Technoscapes involve the global configuration, also ever fluid, of technology and the fact that technology, both high and low, both mechanical and informational, now moves at high speeds across various kinds of previously impervious boundaries. However, a consideration of reproductive tourism has the potential to expand upon Apaterai's theory of globalization. Despite the heuristic appeal of these five discrete global scapes, he stayed at five, he didn't go beyond that. There, in medical anthropology, or for people who are interested in health issues, there could be at least two other scapes of interest, what we might call bioscapes, the global movement of biological things, pathogens, vectors, viruses, you know, the fact that there are biological substances that are moving globally, and the movement of whole body parts, which you might call somatoscapes, things like organs, you know, kidneys, corneas, prostheses, wombs, gametes. So this sort of movement of body bits, as some people like to call it, we could add these escapes to a Apaterai's list. And I actually, instead of thinking of these as sort of discrete scapes, I would like to argue that we could use a sort of meta language of reproscapes, using the notion of scapes. Reproductive tourism might be thought of as this much more complex reproscape, combining numerous dimensions of globalization and global flows. Reproductive tourism certainly involves circulating reproductive technologies, the technoscapes, and also the actors, those who desire the services and those who are the reproductive assisters, the ones who donate their gametes and their wombs and their body parts, leading to this very large-scale industry, a huge industry, the global IVF industry, where there's billions of dollars of finance and capital being circulated. And that's what I was just at in Rome, the huge worldwide meeting where all of the IVF industry was present to sell its wares. And part of this industry is the making of images, all of the imagery around IVF and assisted conception and the flows of the sperm into the egg, and often images of people off on holiday making their babies with the little help of technology. It's quite beautiful, you know, beautiful imagery being put forward in the current new millennium. So we've got this whole, you know, reproscape that's got many pieces to it, and I like to think of it as something that's sort of interrelated. There's another term that's been put forward, I will just say. Oh, and I actually here want to say, what is a scape, according to Apaterai? Why I like the term scape, because he said it's a transnational distribution of correlated elements whose display can be represented as a landscape. And the word skop, I believe it's Dutch, is about things moving across a landscape. And that's the way I like to think of these scapes, that you've got a geography. There's an actual geography of movement, that things and people and ideas are moving from place to place, backwards and forwards. So you've got a geography traversed by these global flows. The scapes are highly gendered. Definitely, technologies are being enacted on men's and women's bodies in very particular ways. And I would say that gender was really never the focus of Arjuna Poddar's work. He was not a gender theorist. And so I think this is something that needs to be added. We need to look at the specificity of technology on the gendered body. And these reproscapes entail new forms of reproductive labor among reproductive assisters who in many cases are women and who are undergoing sometimes very risky forms of stimulation by hormones, the harvesting of their eggs, the penetration of their bodies. This reproductive assistance does have the potential to create almost kin-like female alliances between surrogates and the contracting woman, between women who donate their eggs to their kin. So there's definitely something almost kin-like in some of these transactions. And ova donation in particular, the giving of eggs to other women, invokes notions of altruistic gift exchange between women, especially since ova are sometimes given between sisters or nieces and aunts and that sort of thing. However, it needs to be pointed out that ova are increasingly being sold in the reproductive marketplace for up to $50,000 for what we might call Ivy League ova, or they're also being called Nobel ova. You know, the gametes of girls who go to places like Harvard and Yale and Columbia, there are continuously advertisements being put into the campus newspapers looking for women who are of a certain intellectual capability with actually their SAT scores, their height, their weight, sometimes specifying ethnicity. And so it's a very attractive way to make money. And there's, this says something about the marketplace for ova. And so the whole notion of reproductive assistance, the language of assistance, could be called into question when there is definitely a commercial element here. Is it truly assistance, and is it truly done as an altruistic form of gifting? I just want to bring that into question at this point. Now, the language of reproductive tourism itself, to define this field of global flows, I believe is a bit of a misnomer. It's very important to point out that in some countries, clinics that cater to fertility tourists appear to welcome the development of new markets and have undertaken to market their services so as to create a fantasy of conceiving a child during a romantic holiday. And there are clinics in the Czech Republic and in Singapore, Thailand, in different parts of the world that show beaches next to the IVF clinic. And they try to sort of package this as a holiday. But the question is overseas test tube baby making a holiday? In his excellent theoretical analysis of reproductive tourism, this legal theorist, Richard Storrow, who was with us in Rome, questions the trope of tourism as an appropriate gloss for fertility travel. He notes that tourism is a type of traveling that involves leisure, pleasure, and free time. Fertility tourism, on the other hand, is a very different story. He says, fertility tourism occurs when infertile individuals or couples travel abroad for the purposes of obtaining medical treatment for their infertility. Fertility tourism may also occur in the reverse, when the infertile import the third parties necessary for their fertility treatment. These definitions of fertility tourism are, on the one hand, difficult to harmonize with the idea of tourism as pleasure travel, particularly given that some infertile individuals describe their condition as devastatingly painful and their effort to relieve it as requiring enormous physical and emotional exertion. And so I just want to say that my colleague at Yale and I have coined the term reproductive exile as a better way to capture the subjective experiences of the infertile who are caught in this sort of cycle of traveling, because they definitely object to the term tourism. They find it gimmicky, a mockery of their suffering. They don't think of themselves as tourists when they're moving. Instead, they feel forced to travel. And we heard this over and over in this study that I've done about, if I had the services in my home country legally and affordably, I would never travel. I feel that I'm forced out of my country because of these restrictions. And so we've come up with the term exile as a sort of way to capture the feeling of being pushed from your country of origin. In addition, I want to say that the notion of stratified reproduction, which has been forwarded by the very well-known medical anthropologists Faye Ginsberg and Raina Rapp, seems very appropriate to capture the transnational inequalities whereby some well-to-do couples, the wealthy, are able to, you know, resort to reproductive technologies and to travel, while other infertile couples who don't have the means are basically disempowered as reproducers. So this global reproscape in which reproductive tourism is taking place is a very uneven terrain in that some individuals, some communities, and some nations have achieved greater access to the fruits of globalization, reproductive globalization, than others. And so we need to think about disparities and inequalities, which is a very important theme in global health. That basically it's the middle class to elite who are able to purchase these services while couples who are infertile but don't have the economic means can never begin to access these ARTs. In my previous book on in vitro fertilization in Egypt, I examined numerous local barriers to ART access, and I called these arenas of constraint, the structural, ideological, social, relational, and practical obstacles and apprehensions that constrain and sometimes prohibit the uses of ARTs. And that was basically looking at it from the standpoint of one country. But nearly a decade later, we still don't know very much about the various arenas of constraint that face infertile couples in their transnational quests for ARTs. So what happens when people have to leave Egypt and go across borders to access ARTs? Now, one of the big theories about why people are moving so much now is that basically a reason for reproductive travel has to do with the lack of access to human gametes around the world. Several Western nations, some important Western nations, including Italy, Norway, the two countries where I just was this week, Italy and Norway, Great Britain, Canada, Germany, a variety of European nations have enacted rather strict legislation prohibiting either some or all forms of gamete donation, and especially anonymous gamete donation, where you can't get any information about the donor, as well as gestational surrogacy. Many countries disallow gestational surrogacy. So these restrictions in the EU have triggered European fertility tourism on a massive scale, mostly of Western European infertile couples to the white post-Soviet bloc of Eastern Europe, countries such as the Ukraine, Czech Republic, Russia, Slovenia, Romania, and so on. There, clinics can employ the internet to attract fertility tourists with promises of cut-rate in vitro fertilization, high success rates, liberal reproductive policies, and little administrative oversight. Furthermore, young women in these Eastern Bloc countries may comprise a vulnerable population of egg donors who are compelled out of economic necessity to sell their ova in the local reproductive marketplace. Given the newly recognized category of the traveling foreign egg donor who seeks economic mobility through the sale of her body parts, Richard Storrow points to the parallels between unregulated fertility tourism and sex tourism, as young women in the economically deteriorated post-communist societies discover that both prostitution and egg donation offer economic rewards. He has argued that egg donation, like prostitution, will be especially attractive in regions of the world where large numbers of women with few choices want to improve their economic circumstances by any means available. So the commodification of the body and its parts, selling gametes for the purposes of reproduction, as well as, I should say, selling organs for the purposes of transplant, this has really become a major area of concern for legal scholars, and as well as scholars in my own field of anthropology, medical anthropology. We're trying to embark on empirical research in the new millennium that is trying to understand these markets and organs and gametes and other body parts. And I should say that in my world of assisted reproductive technologies, the commodification of the body, you know, bodily penetration, fragmentation, commodification, has been operating now since the late 1970s, when the first test tube baby was born in England, in the UK, in this country in 1978. Her name was Louise Brown. She was the first test tube baby. She was conceived of working class parents who basically were facing tubal factor infertility, and so IVF worked for them. And that was the beginning of what's become a huge industry. I have to say that when Louise Brown turned 25 in the year 2004, there was a lot of media celebration about world's first baby turns 25, with a lot of images of her with her folks. And I always say that when you see her, you know that her father's spermatozoa had to be used in her conception, because she actually looks, I think, exactly like her father. And anyway, she's now over 30. We just celebrated the 30th year of assisted reproduction. So every time, every 5 years, there's going to be another celebration, I guarantee. And there's going to be a really big one when it turns 50, I think. But at any rate, just I want to show you what's happened since she was born in terms of the commodification of the body and its parts. The new ARTs, we now have this one that I'm writing a book on called Intracytoplasmic Sperm Injection, or ICSI, which I just have to ask, how many of you have ever heard of ICSI? Okay. About good, at least half of you. That's higher than the normal audience. ICSI is a variant of IVF that's been around since the early 1990s, and it really has revolutionized the treatment of male infertility. It's a variant of IVF to overcome male infertility, and it's actually the most common ART performed in the world today, because it's sort of outpacing IVF as the primary ART. Then we have third-party gamete donation of sperm, eggs, embryos, uteruses as in surrogacy. There is multifetal pregnancy reduction being done to abort high-order multiple gestational pregnancies as a result of ARTs, where you have triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets. They go in and penetrate the fetal heart and reduce the pregnancy, usually down to twins. Ooplasm transfer, or OT, is being done to improve egg quality in perimenopausal women by taking the cytoplasm of a younger woman's gametes and injecting into the old eggs of postmenopausal women to try to improve their quality. Cryopreservation of unused embryos. Embryos can be frozen, and now the newest ART that's just come into being is the freezing of eggs, which has huge implications for women, older women, who can store their eggs and put them, you know, on storage in a freezer until they decide they want to have children. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, to select against embryos with certain genetic defects, and this is now being used to select for embryos of a specific sex. It's being used as a sex selection technique in some parts of the world. Embryonic stem cell research is being done on the unused embryos cast off from IVF clinics in parts of the world for the purposes of therapeutic stem cells, and our colleague Aditya Bharadwaj has worked on this in India. And then there is the future possibility of asexual autonomous reproduction through human cloning, which to our knowledge has not yet successfully taken place, but we know that Dolly the sheep was a clone and that animals have been cloned, and so people are extremely concerned about when a human clone will come into existence, and there have been some international bioethical guidelines to prevent human cloning. Now, with virtually all of these technologies, sperm and eggs are retrieved from bodies, embryos are returned to bodies, and sometimes they're donated to other bodies or used for the purposes of stem cell and other forms of medical research. As noted by numerous infertility scholars in recent years, ARTs exact a significant physical toll on the body, especially for women as both recipients of ARTs and as ova donors. Furthermore, despite the existence of national and international statements opposing the commercialization of ART services, significant commodification has occurred as gametes and embryos are increasingly sold or adopted sometimes on the open market through internet websites and college newspapers with advertisements such as "Sperm donors needed, we will pay." Ruth Deitch has written an article on reproductive tourism in Europe questioning the human rights implications of the documented massive global transfer within the EU of sperm eggs and embryos being passed from country to country in search of one that permits the desired treatment or allows the chosen gametes to be used. And I have to say that the most recent legislation in places like the UK have basically disallowed anonymous donation. And so if you're going to donate your sperm or your eggs to others, it's with the proviso that when the child, the offspring, becomes 18, they will have legal recourse to the records to know who the parent, the biological, provider is, and this has scared off donors, especially male donors. All those men who pass along their sperm aren't so keen on having hundreds of children show up at age 18 to say, "Dad, I've always missed you." So there's a lot of discussion about the market. You know, what's going to happen to the market as sperm donors dry up? No pun intended. And the one country that is actually exporting the most donor sperm around the world at this time is Denmark. Denmark doesn't have this requirement, and they have a major industry in sperm donation, and they send their vials of Viking sperm all over the world. So increasingly, we're going to have half Danish children being born in places like, you know, the U.S. and India and so on. Okay. So this is what's going on in Europe and the UK with a lot of complication and a lot of discussion. It's quite a hot topic right now. Many panels around the world on reproductive tourism, what it means, the market, should it be regulated? There's a fantastic book by a Harvard business professor, Deborah Spar, called The Baby Business, looking at this as a huge global market. And I became interested because I've been working for a long time on ARTs in the Middle East, and I'm going to argue that the Middle East is different from the EU countries, is also different from the United States in terms of its attitudes toward commodification and this bodily flow of human gametes. In the Middle East, there is a flourishing ART industry with hundreds of IVF clinics in countries ranging from the small Arab Gulf states to the larger but less prosperous nations of North Africa. For example, Iran has more than 50 clinics, so does Egypt, so does Saudi Arabia. Turkey is the leader with more than 100 ART clinics. This fluorescence of a mostly private Middle Eastern ART industry is not surprising. Islam encourages the use of science and medicine as solutions to human suffering and is a religion that can be described as pronatalist, encouraging the growth of an Islamic multitude. Yet, relatively little is known about Islam and technoscience, if technoscience is defined broadly as the interconnectedness between science and technology through epistemological, institutional, and cultural discursive practices. As noted by Lotfalian in a recent monograph on Islam, technoscientific identities, and the culture of curiosity, there is a glaring lacuna in the literature on science and technology in cross-cultural perspective, and particularly from the Islamic world, where he says that there are really only two relevant strains of work being done, first on the Islamic medieval sciences, and then secondly on the philosophical arguments for civilizational differences between Islamic and Western science and technology. This is what's called the clash of civilizations argument that's been promoted by Samuel Huntington from Harvard, that the Islamic world and the Western world are in some sort of an historic and, you know, a clash with each other, which has been a problem between the two parts of the world. And I don't agree with that clash of civilizations argument, and I think you'll see why. So we don't know much about Islam and what kind of high-tech science and medicine goes on in Muslim countries. For example, the major volume called Third Party Assisted Conception Across Cultures, Social, Legal, and Ethical Perspectives has 13 case studies, country case studies, and not a single Muslim country is included. So the time has come to examine the globalization of ARTs to diverse contexts, including those in the Muslim world, particularly given the very rapid deployment of these technologies. In addition to examining the ART technoscape, it's equally important to examine the ethnoscape of reproductive actors as they move across the Muslim world. And as I want to show in the rest of the time, reproductive tourism in the Middle East bespeaks a complex reproscape of moving people, technologies, gametes, money, images, and ideas involving the pursuit of conception. That infertile Middle Eastern couples are willing to participate in this reproscape bespeaks the love, commitment, and ardent desire for children that characterize most couples in the Middle East, but which are rarely emphasized in the Western media discourses about the purported violence, fanaticism, and cruelty of Arab men to women. As we're going to see, the love between infertile Middle Eastern Muslim couples is fueling the IVF industry in the Middle East, and it's also causing some couples to venture abroad in search of gametes for reasons that I hope to make clear. And so I just want to say a little bit very quickly about my study. I began in Egypt in the 1980s, basically looking at infertility among poor Egyptian couples, and I coined the term quest for conception to talk about the way that infertile couples, even with very little, few means, were traveling within the country, searching ardently and avidly to try to make babies. And at this time in the late 1980s, test tube babies were just coming into existence in Egypt. The first clinics opened in 1986 in the country, and there was a lot of discussion. And then I went back to Egypt in 1996 when the industry was flourishing. There were about 10 clinics at that time, and I basically went and worked out of two of the sort of busiest private IVF clinics in Cairo, where I interviewed about 66 Egyptian, mostly Muslim couples who were undertaking ARTs in the country, but had been moving back and forth for various reasons. They'd been moving to the Arab Gulf, some of them had gone to Europe, and I saw this thing, which hadn't yet been called reproductive tourism, but I wrote about the movement across international borders of Egyptian couples in their quest for conception. I reapplied to go to Egypt in the early 2000s, in the new millennium, to do a study of male infertility called Middle Eastern Masculinities in the Age of New Reproductive Technologies. I was all set to go there, and my research proposal got rejected a grand total of 4 times by the Egyptian Mukhabarat, the intelligence services in Egypt, who kept sending it back saying nothing about men, masculinity, or fertility. and I, you know, it was devastating to me because I wanted to continue to work in Egypt on the topic, but my husband finally said, Marcia, it's obviously you're not going to get into the country. It seems to be a sensitive topic, and so you need to look elsewhere. And so I did. I couldn't get research permission to work in Egypt on male infertility. So I ended up going to Lebanon, which had ended its civil war, and they were very enthusiastic to start research projects there again. And so I had no trouble getting permission to work in Lebanon, and I ended up doing a large-scale study of more than 200 men out of, again, 2 private, very busy IVF clinics in Beirut, Lebanon. And I'm actually writing a book now based on my long-term study of male infertility in an era of ICSI. I returned, at that time I was at the University of Michigan for 8 years before I moved to Yale 2 years ago. And it is located next to the largest population of Arab Americans in North America, which has been called Arab Detroit. Southeast Michigan is the home of a failing auto industry, and many Arabs had come there in the 1900s to work for Henry Ford, and then chain migration, they brought their families. And I worked there in an Arab-serving IVF clinic in this place called Dearborn, Michigan, which is an ethnic enclave. And there I met very poor, mostly refugees from Iraq and Lebanon and Palestine who hoped to access ARTs to make their babies, but were having great difficulty given how expensive it is to do this in the United States. And then very importantly, in February and March 2006, I was invited to Iran, which as you're going to see is the hub, really the hub of some interesting the hub of the reproscape in the Muslim Middle East now, for reasons that I'm going to make clear. But I was invited to go to a conference there called Embryo and Gamete Donation, and I was invited. I'm not Muslim, and I'm obviously American. I was invited to go and represent the Sunni Muslim position on IVF and gamete donation to an almost entirely Iranian Shia Muslim population, including the entire first row was Ayatollahs wearing turbans and cloaks. And, you know, it was sort of surreal for me, but it was very interesting because I saw the kind of legal argumentation in the Muslim world in action at that conference. And Iran, as you're going to see, is paving the way into a new world of ARTs in this region of the world. And then in 2007, I moved to the Arab Gulf to start this project on reproductive tourism. And as you may know, Dubai, before the financial collapse, was the global hub for this section of the world, for the Middle East and for much of South Asia, huge movements of people coming from South Asia to the Arab Gulf, to Dubai, and really, as we'll see, the whole world. I met people from about 50 countries. I interviewed more than 200 travelers coming from 50 countries. And so I feel like, to some degree, I've now seen the world in the Middle East in my study of reproductive travel. And so I want to talk to you about what I would call the local moral worlds that I discovered in these various settings in the Middle East, and how Muslim infertile couples are sort of understanding why they travel and what they're pursuing in their reproductive travel. And although I would argue that there are many reasons why Muslim infertile couples travel, it's really, in many cases, travel for the procurement of human gametes that they cannot acquire in their own countries. And it was really the Harvard medical anthropologist Arthur Kleinman who coined this term local moral worlds to try to get at what he called the commitments of social participants in a local world about what is at stake in everyday experience, what matters ethically to human beings when they make a decision to use a biomedical technology or to travel for some reason or another. And I became very interested in what I would call the local moral worlds, the evolving moral religious climate surrounding the use of ARTs as they intersect with Islam and what Islam has to say about these technologies. And to understand this, you need to examine fatwas, which are non-legally binding but authoritative religious decrees. And in some cases, the ethical and bioethical rulings that are being issued following the issuance of these fatwas, which in some cases end up overturning these fatwa declarations. And so in the Middle East, we have a world of fatwa making, these religious documents and proclamations that are made by religious authorities and then have to be interpreted by physicians and patients who are trying to make sense of what is religiously permissible within their own local moral world. And the big question for me was, when faced with the need for donor gametes to overcome their infertility, what do Muslim IVF patients do? Is the search for human gametes one of the major motivating factors for reproductive tourism in the Middle East? And you know, this, I think, is a very compelling question for what we might call an Islamic technoscience in practice. And so I want to take you now into the local moral worlds of the Middle East, of the Islamic Middle East. And to do so, we have to begin with Sunni Islam, and particularly the decision that was made by the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar University, which is probably the most important Sunni Muslim religious university. It's located in Cairo, Egypt. And on March 23, 1980, the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar issued the first fatwa on medically assisted reproduction. And this is a fatwa that has proved to be very authoritative and enduring in all of the main points. This Al-Azhar fatwa has been re-examined over the years since 1980, and basically all of the main points of this original fatwa have been upheld by other fatwas issued since then in countries such as Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, and beyond. And so basically, this Al-Azhar fatwa has been very authoritative for the Sunni Muslim world. So what is the Sunni Muslim position on ARTs? Basically, IVF is permitted in Sunni Islam as long as the eggs are from the wife, the sperm are from the husband, and the embryo made from the sperm and eggs in the laboratory the embryos are put back into the uterus of the same wife. So IVF was declared allowable from the very beginning. Shortly after Louise Brown was born, the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar said it's okay to do IVF as long as you're using gametes from a husband and wife. However, What is not allowed is any form of third-party donation, whether of sperm, eggs, embryos, or uteruses, as in surrogacy. And this is because marriage is an inviolable kind of institution in the Muslim world, and it was argued that a third party would basically intrude into the marital functions of sex and procreation. Ibrahim Musa, who's a very important Islamic legal scholar at Duke University, says, in terms of ethics, Muslim authorities consider the transmission of reproductive material between persons who are not legally married to be a major violation of Islamic law. This sensitivity stems from the fact that Islamic law has a strict taboo on sexual relations outside wedlock, which is called zina. Any kind of illegal sex is called zina. The taboo is designed to protect paternity, i.e. the family, which is designated as one of the five goals of Islamic law, the others being the protection of religion, life, property, and reason. So it's very important that you keep the ARTs within the married unit. And this was declared basically a very important declaration in 1997. There was a major conference held in Morocco by an organization called IOMS, the Islamic Organization for Medical Sciences. And they basically came up with a major bioethical declaration, a landmark sort of declaration, saying we are not going to allow human cloning, that is not Islamic, and we prohibit all forms of third-party donation. And this is basically a ban that is in place in the Sunni Muslim world. I would argue that you cannot go to any Sunni Muslim country in the Middle East or beyond and legally obtain third-party donor gametes. It is simply not allowed. And this is important because there are about 1.4 billion Muslims in the world today, and Sunni Muslims are about 90% of them. So this is a ban that affects a huge number of people around the world. And it's a very effective ban. Physicians in Sunni Muslim places are quite frightened of even possibly thinking of offering third-party donation in their clinics because they're violating this ban can, you know, result in jail, imprisonment, very serious repercussions. And so a survey was done to see, well, is it true that this ban is really in place? It was carried out in a global survey, which was published, and it showed that all of the Muslim countries, in a 62-country survey of all of the Muslim countries at that time, in a large global survey of ART, that basically in all of them, the Middle Eastern ones on the left and the non-Middle Eastern ones on the right, basically in all of them, there was no sperm donation being practiced in these countries, and there was no form of any kind of donation, no gamete donation of any kind was being practiced in these countries. And the authors of that big global survey said in many Islamic countries where the laws of Islam are the laws of the state, the donation of sperm was not practiced. Artificial insemination by donor is considered adultery and leads to confusion regarding the lines of genealogy, whose purity is of prime importance in Islam. Now, I then went to the Muslim world and started talking to people about their attitudes toward gamete donation. What did they think about it? And I found in, you know, hundreds of interviews that I've done with Sunni Muslims in a variety of countries, there's very strong patient opposition to the, even the idea of donation. And there are three reasons. First has to do with adultery. It has been argued that third-party donation is kind of like, it's tantamount to adultery, because it's basically introducing a stranger into the intimate marital union. And especially for men, the idea of their wife taking sperm from another guy is just beyond the pale. Men just said, you know, it would be as if my wife slept with another man. And they start fantasizing about that possibility, and they do not want to go there. And actually, I have to tell you, studies in the West show that when you take gametes from other people, there is a level of fantasy making on the level of ideas about who this donor person might be, what they look like, you know, and so on. And so this is a big concern. The second concern is about incest, the potential for incest. If you have an anonymous donor, a man, for example, who has donated, you know, lots of sperm and has created 100 offspring, in a small country like Lebanon, these children could grow up, meet each other, fall in love, and marry, and you would basically be having the union of half-siblings, which in Islam is definitely considered to be incest. And this is a concern even in the United States about the children of anonymous sperm donors. Will they end up, you know, marrying their half-sibling? And then finally, third-party donation confuses kinship, paternity, descent, and inheritance in the very patrilineal societies of the Muslim Middle East. And according to Muslims, preserving the origins of each child, particularly the relationship to a known father, but also to a known mother, is considered not only to be an ideal, but actually a moral imperative. This is a very important Islamic imperative that every child should know its biological mother and father. And the problem with donation is that it is said to destroy a child's nasab, or lineage, genealogy, which is considered to be not only immoral, but psychologically devastating to the child. So Sunni Muslim IVF patients describe this as a mixture of relations. They say a mixture of relations of, you know, from unknown lineage is a very bad thing. They say it really allows a stranger to enter the family. If you don't know who this person is, you're mixing up your lineage with a stranger, which is considered to be haram, something forbidden. And children who would emerge from such a sort of mixed mixture are considered to be ibn haram, which is literally son of the forbidden, or sometimes called walad zinna, the son of illicit sexuality, basically a bastard. The belief is that with third-party gamete donation, you are creating a bastard child who's going to have a very difficult life ahead of him or her. And this conviction that parenthood of a donor child is an impossibility is very much linked to the legal and cultural prohibitions against adoption throughout the Sunni Muslim world. The original Al-Azhar fatwa prohibited third-party gamete donation along the same lines that adoption is prohibited, considering both of these things to be unallowable. Actually, if you ask most Sunni Muslim patients whether they would consider adoption as a way of, you know, finding children, most of them won't contemplate it. They say it's against the religion. They can't begin to imagine adoption, legal adoption, as a solution to the childlessness. And when I asked particularly Arab men about what they thought about adoption, most of them said to me, he won't be my son. Simple as that. An adopted child, like a donor child, won't be my son. It would be like I was raising a stranger's child. Why should I raise another man's child? And so very strongly felt. So given this local moral world, most Sunni IVF patients are extremely concerned about making test tube babies in the morally correct fashion. To that end, they often want to seek out a trustworthy Sunni Muslim IVF practitioner, even if it means costly travel to another country. On the other hand, the need for a co-religionist in the practice of IVF also proves to be a potent barrier to reproductive tourism on the part of many elite Sunni Muslims who, even though they might think of traveling abroad, particularly to the West, they might think of coming to a place like London to carry out their ARTs, they're very concerned that they can't find a good Muslim IVF practitioner to do the treatment for them. And so people contemplate these things. Who can I trust to make my IVF baby? Now that's just a sort of a snapshot of the Sunni Muslim world and the Sunni Muslim ban on gamete donation. And then I have to say that everything changed for Shia Muslims since that global survey was published in 1997. Just to reiterate, Shia Islam is the minority version. About 10% of the world's Muslims are Shia. They are the dominant group in Iran, probably in Iraq and Lebanon and Bahrain as well. And then you find Shia minorities in the countries of Syria, on the east coast of Saudi Arabia, and in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Many Shia religious authorities support the majority Sunni view. Namely, they agree that third-party donation is haram. It is not religiously acceptable. And one of the major proponents of that view is the very important, one of the most revered Islamic thinkers in Shia Islam, Ayatollah Ali Sistani in Iraq, who he and his son have written a large volume basically about ARTs and why third-party gamete donation should not be allowed. However, this is very interesting. In the very end of the 1990s, the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who is named Ayatollah Ali Hussein Khamenei, who was the hand-picked successor to Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, issued a fatwa effectively permitting donor technologies to be used under certain conditions. He said, with regard to both egg and sperm donation, both these things would be allowed as long as both the donor and infertile parents would abide by the religious codes governing parenting. He said, you know, you can do this, but the donor and the infertile parents need to sort of cooperate with each other. And the donor child can only inherit from the donor, okay? Because the donor father is really the real father in some senses of this child, and so inheritance flows from the donor to the child. The infertile parents, in his reasoning, are something akin to adoptive parents. They're taking they're parenting this child created from donor gametes, but the real parent of the child is the person who donated the sperm or the egg. And once this fatwa was issued in 1999, it immediately created all sorts of interesting disagreements in the Shia world, because the Shia practice something and they value something called ijtihad, which is putting a lot of value on individual religious reasoning, the use of your own mind and intellect to make the right moral decision. And so as soon as the fatwa was, you know, issued, there began to be many disagreements on these kinds of issues. Does third-party donation constitute zina or adultery if there is no touch or gaze? If you're actually not touching the donor or even gazing at the donor, is that really like adultery? Some say yes, some say no. Should the child follow the name of the infertile father or the sperm donor? Should they take the name of the infertile man or the sperm donor from whom they're supposed to inherit? Is donation permissible if the donors are anonymous? Theoretically, no, because you're supposed to have a known donor, right? And since most donation is around the world occurs anonymously, what do we do about that? Do they have to meet each other? Should there be some sort of an agreement? And in fact, should there be a marriage agreement? If it's an infertile woman and her husband is willing to let donor gametes be used, donor eggs be used, should he really do a temporary muta marriage with the egg donor during the period of time from the harvesting of her eggs to the transfer of the embryo into the infertile wife's uterus? And in fact, this is what's being invoked in some Shia-serving IVF clinics. They do these sort of little temporary marriages, which are allowed in Shia Islam, but which are disallowed and in fact considered to be a very bad thing in Sunni Islam. So, you know, this is an interesting sort of Shia version of a temporary marriage. And then what about sperm donation? If the husband is infertile, where does this leave his wife? What should she do? Could a married Shia woman who's got a very infertile husband, could she do a temporary muta marriage with a sperm donor? This is a big question. In fact, I would like to pose this question to the audience. Could a Shia woman married to an infertile man, should she marry the sperm donor, like her husband would marry the egg donor? What do you think? Yes or no? In Shia reasoning.
Not allowed.
Maya, why not allowed?
Well, because then it's adultery, isn't it?
Is it adultery?
Isn't it?
If she doesn't sleep with him, she just takes the sperm through,
no,
you know.
In Shia, I think, according
okay.
to... Not according to me.
Okay, yeah. You're saying in the thought process, yeah. It could be seen as adultery. Yeah. But wouldn't it also be seen as adultery if the husband married the...
He's allowed to take more than one wife.
What's that?
He's allowed to take more than one wife.
He's allowed to take more than one wife, but she...
But she can't take more than one
husband. Okay.
No, so she's allowed to have serially more than one husband, and so she should be allowed to do a muta marriage.
If
separates from her husband, mm-hmm. gets married, and then gets divorced again, mm-hmm. and gets married to the husband again, it is permitted.
You're quite pragmatic.
very pragmatic, and that's in fact what's happening in Iran. You got it there. So yeah, because you know, technically, yes, you're right. Polygyny, marriage of one man to more than one woman, is allowed, but polyandry, the marriage of one woman to more than one man, is hardly allowed any place in the entire world. And so this pragmatism, which you use the term, is indeed what's happening, particularly in Iran, where there's a now thriving, you know, thriving industry of gamete donation, mota marriages, and now gestational surrogacy, which is being followed by a number of young scholars. And so, but technically, I just want to say that you could use, you know, theoretically, who should use sperm, donor sperm? It would theoretically have to be somebody who was single at that moment, you know, a widowed woman or a single woman. And this is indeed what's happening in the world of sperm donation in the EU and the States. Women now, single women, are using donor sperm and they're creating children on their own. I will wager that this is not going to become socially acceptable anytime soon in the Muslim Middle East that I know. And so there's, I doubt there's ever going to be a big demand for donor sperm. But in cases where men are seriously infertile, this is now beginning to happen in Iran. So single motherhood. But Iran recently made sperm donation illegal. They said that, you know, they didn't really like the idea of women doing this, you know, this sort of enacting this kind of temporary divorce, temporary muta, and so forth. But the power of the legal system, they can't enforce this because why? Ayatollah Ali Hussein Khamenei, his fatwa for those who follow him is more powerful than the Iranian law. And so all the clinics have to do is invoke the fatwa and say, well, our Ayatollah says it's okay, and so we can do it. And so despite the law that came down in about 2004, all manner of donation is happening in Iran. Everything is going there. Everything's going on in Iran. And by the way, it is the world's number one spot for transgendered surgery as well. Iran is the country to follow. It's really, and it's got a huge stem cell industry as well. So Iran's a very interesting place. Now, in practice, I just want to tell you, Shiat gamete donation in practice, most couples still have a hard time wrapping their minds around the whole thing. Because if you were truly concerned about carrying out this third-party donation according to religious guidelines, it would be very difficult to meet all the requirements, and especially in the case of sperm donation. Yet, having said that, gamete donation is now occurring quite commonly in two countries. To my knowledge, only two places in the Muslim world are allowing these practices. It is Iran and Lebanon, which is a Shia majority country, followed along with the Iranian lead. And so since the new millennium, donor gametes are being traded and purchased and circulated by infertile couples in these two countries. And they're the only two Muslim countries to allow this practice. And it's interesting, in the clinics that offer these services, they invoke Ayatollah Khamenei's reasoning. He said, and these are literally his words, that gamete donation is a marriage savior, helping to avoid the marital and psychological disputes that may arise if the couple's case is otherwise untreatable. Ironically, Ayatollah Khamenei, who can't be put, you know, out there as an example of a feminist, you know, he's not on the forefront of feminism. Nonetheless, he used a gendered argument, and especially one that was sensitive to women's situation, as the primary reason for why he allowed donor technologies in the country. So let's just talk about, oops, sorry, I'm behind here, who are the sources of donor eggs? First, we have other IVF patients who are sometimes asked to donate excess eggs or embryos in the clinic. Friends or relatives, sister egg sharing, relative egg sharing is very popular in Iran and in Lebanon. And there are anonymous donors who are being recruited into clinics, and they're being given fees for their services. And I have to tell you that at least one of the clinics in which I worked in Lebanon, it was a very conservative clinic, catering to very conservative Shia clientele. The donors were being recruited from the United States. They were young, non-Muslim American women who, for $1,000 extra, were traveling from the Midwest to Lebanon to donate their eggs to infertile Lebanese couples. And so who are the Lebanese couples most likely to receive such such donor eggs, including from Americans. In Lebanon, they would generally be the most conservative Shia Muslim couples, including sympathizers with or members of Hezbollah. And I, you know, really note the irony here of American non-Muslim donor eggs going into the bodies of Hezbollah members in Lebanon. The eggs converted very quickly. What's that? Yeah, no.
The eggs get converted.
Yes, they do. Yeah, but these Hezbollah couples are not, no, they're not converting the eggs. They're literally just taking the eggs because they need the eggs. There's a demand for eggs. And there are now Sunni Muslims who are sneaking over from places like Syria and Egypt and the Arab Gulf to Beirut on holiday, usually in great secrecy, to basically access these gametes in one of two places where they're able to do this in the Muslim world. So basically, in the new millennium, there is reproductive tourism happening, Sunni reproductive tourism happening under the cloak of anonymity and confidentiality. It's a very secret kind of donation going on. And often, Muslim couples, they don't want to go to Spain, which happens to be the EU hub of egg donation. They don't want to go to Spain. They don't want to go to America. They don't want to go to Norway or some other country because they want to achieve phenotypic similarity. They want to look like the parents of this donor child because it's going to be a secret donor child. And this is why they're going to Iran. And I find it interesting. Iran is not an Arab country. Iran is a Persian empire. It's got a different language. It has a history that's not always so friendly with the Arab world. But there's now a huge flow of Arabs, especially from the Arab Gulf, to Iran because, you know, basically they want to get phenotypically similar children. And so, you know, again, another irony that you've got these sort of Shia Persian gametes going into the bodies of Sunni Arab Muslims against all odds, given that there are some tensions between these two groups now in the Middle East. So, it's a brave new world. And I'm going to end by saying we've got significant medical transnationalism and reproductive tourism operating in the Muslim Middle East in a place where, you know, really I never thought it would happen because of this strict Sunni ban, but things changed. We see the mixing of gametes across national, ethnic, racial, and religious lines. The birth of hundreds of donor babies to Muslim couples who feel very devout. They're practicing Muslims, but they've done this anyhow and gone into the world of donation. It's leading to a reconsideration of the importance of biological kinship. You know, does one have to be a biological parent, or is social parenthood something to consider? And definitely, the introduction of donor technologies has weakened the Sunni Muslim ban on third-party donation. People are now going against their religion in order to seek these gametes to overcome their problems. And so we see Shia gametes entering into Sunni bodies in the new millennium. And I was going to tell you the story, a sort of sad story of these Syrian reproductive tourists who went to Beirut on an egg quest. But I think I'm not going to for the interest of time. I just want to conclude in terms of Islamic modernity to say that, you know, the Middle East is rarely thought of as a place of modernity. It's, you know, seen as a backwater where you've got, you know, Islamic fanaticism, and a lot of derogatory epithets are used to describe this part of the world. Yet, you know, for a long time, since the 1980s, the Middle East has been using these technologies, and other kinds of high-tech medical technologies are being deployed in this part of the world, including, you know, live patient liver transplants for the huge problem of hepatitis C in Egypt. All manner of, you know, high-tech surgery is occurring in the Middle East, and Iran has really been leading the way in many ways in terms of science and technology, and people want to be known as, you know, living in a place where the new new technologies are being offered and received in society. And this is just a picture from a Beirut IVF clinic where this embryologist is doing ICSI, which is a very high-tech maneuver requiring this particular type of microscope with a micromanipulator. It costs a lot of money. It's a huge investment, but it's being done in Beirut and in Cairo and in Marrakesh, all over the Muslim world. And so I see this as a sort of interesting example of both the globalization of high-tech science, the importance of bioethics and understanding religion and the implications of religion for sort of local morality and bioethics, the importance of understanding the gender dimensions of these global flows and how men's and women's bodies are affected differently in the world of globalization, and just basically an intersection of many different and important and fascinating phenomena flowing around in an increasingly globalized world today. So thank you. And I would just actually like to say one thing about India. I often think about India because it's got one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. And we do have a number of wonderful scholars working on various aspects of ARTs in India, including Maya and Aditya Bhardwaj and others. But there's a bit of a silence about what's going on in the Muslim population in terms of ARTs. Most of the work has come out of Hindu serving clinics, and we know that there are Muslim patients, but little is known about what happens to them, whether they're accepting donor gametes, because India is a place where donor gametes are flowing, sperm donors, egg donors, everything's going on in India just as it is in Iran. So someone needs to do that study. Yeah, there and then there. Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, very good question. The book that I'm writing now, sort of based in Lebanon. I mean, I did this big study in Lebanon, and there's a significant Christian population, about 30%, although it's really not known what the total population is. And Egypt, too, has a 10% Coptic Orthodox population. And it varies. The Copts in Egypt have completely gone along with the Sunni thinking on the subject, and so the Copts will not do any kind of third-party gamete donation. In Lebanon, which is always been sort of European, focused. I mean, the Christians of Lebanon have felt very allied with France and other parts of Europe. And so this little Iranian opening that occurred in 1999, by 2000, 2001, Christian physicians in the IVF community in Lebanon jumped on the bandwagon and said, great, it's allowed us to offer something that we believe in, even though most of the Lebanese Christian physicians are Catholic Maronites. So they're Catholic, and theoretically, because they're Catholic, Catholicism doesn't allow any of these ARTs. Yet the Christian community has been very eagerly, accepted doing gamete donation. And, I worked with quite a few Christian patients and physicians. I would say Christians in general in Lebanon were the most accepting of the possibility of sperm donation, even more than the Shia Muslim men that I interviewed. Lebanese Christians said, they do it in France, they do it, I'm willing to try it. But so there are Christians. I've written a couple pieces about that issue. Yeah.
Is there any sense you feel there's an arms race, as far as I get this concerned?
An arms race, yeah.
Yeah. In other words, one part of the world is trying to outdo the other. Because until your talk, I was sort of IBS as a very personal thing for people who want to have children, but it almost seems to be taken away from the person to countries and religions and other groups.
Yeah, that's a great way of capturing it. That's a great term because, I think there is an arms race going on, actually. And it's very strongly felt in the words that are used to describe various countries. U.S. is the Wild West of ART, And Italy used to be the Wild West of Europe. And now it's not, because very strict legislation came down in about 2004. Spain is now, you know, out there on as the leader in egg donation. Denmark is the leader in sperm donation. Yeah, countries are positioning themselves in this sort of global reproscape as the place to go, you know, to get these services. And I'll tell you, you know, here I was in Rome. In this, we had a whole day on reproductive tourism, a huge session on reproductive tourism. And there were clinics in the Ukraine and Bulgaria that were there with little brochures like, come to Ukraine, we'll bring you over to check out our services. You know, people, the countries and clinics are vying to get into this market, this global market. And so the EU nations in particular have been very concerned. There are a group of scholars, all from the EU, that have done some big questionnaire-based comparative work about where are patients from countries going and flowing. It was just published in Human Reproduction, a big European journal. And they're concerned about, you know, these flows of Italians are the most flowing people because they now have the strictest legislation, and they're mostly flowing to Spain and Switzerland. The Germans are going to the Czech Republic. They have charted it all out. And so people are saying, we need to harmonize here, legally harmonize, which would be kind of a nightmare. So yeah, there is a global race and consideration of where the flows are going and why, and a real concern. There's a lot of policy discussion that this isn't good. That it isn't good that you've got, you know, wealthy Italians are going here and there. And then, you know, I'll tell you, somebody from a Spanish clinic came, and Spain is now recognized as the number one supplier of ova for Europe. And so everyone in the European community at this session, they were so curious. They asked them a lot of questions about where the gametes were coming from, because there's been a lot of circulating rumors that that, you know, Eastern European women are being shipped over for very low prices to, you know, have their eggs harvested in Spain, and that Romani, gypsy populations, local populations are being exploited, you know, with very low, again, paid very low prices to have their eggs don't, you know, harvested in these clinics. And so there's a lot of what would you call global gossip about what's going on in these places. And this woman said, oh no, we only use the local eggs. The Spanish women are the most altruistic in the whole world. It's very interesting to listen to these discourses, you know. And so there is a young anthropologist from Germany who's studying the eggs in Spain. Yes, Maya.
I was wondering how much do population anxieties feed into this, and how much do they help in deregulation? And I'm, you know, reminded of, you know, both Rhoda Kanani's work, mm-hmm. but also Susan Kahn's work, where mm-hmm. the whole idea is to, you know, have a larger population to counter, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of threats that you feel. And perhaps with the Muslim world now feeling more sort of threatened, is that something that feeds into this?
Yeah, you know, there's a wonderful book, which Maya knows about and is referred to. There are actually two wonderful books. One is called Reproducing Jews, A Cultural Account of Assisted Conception in Israel, and one called Birthing the Nation, Strategies of Palestinian Women in Israel. And it's about the situation of Israel. Just, you know, Israel is the most pro-ART regime in the world. It is the most generous state subsidization of ARTs. You can get 6 free cycles of ARTs up to the birth of 2 children if you are a citizen of Israel. And it doesn't matter if you're single, gay, whatever configuration, they've worked it out. The rabbis have been very, very accommodating of these technologies, and the argument is that it's so pronatalist. You know, the Jewish state needs to reproduce Jewish citizens. And so, but Palestinians, that's always the question, do Palestinians in Israel get, you know, ART services? If you are a Palestinian citizen of the state of Israel, you live in Haifa or in Galilee, yes, you do. And so it's one of the sort of paradoxical benefits of being a Palestinian in the state of Israel. The West Bank, Gaza, it's a different story. But yeah, in Italy, when we were just there in Italy, we had 2 Italians talking about, you know, the horrors of what they had to do when the strict law came down in 2004, how they had to throw away all their frozen embryos, and, you know, the tragedy of the Italian law. And You know, I asked the question, Italy is one of the barren states. It has one of the lowest total fertility rates in the world, in Europe. And doesn't the Catholic Church care about making babies? They showed that each year something like 4,000 children weren't born as a result of this restrictive legislation. And they said, no, the Catholic Church did not care about that. They weren't thinking in population terms. They were thinking in terms of the embryo, the sanctity of the embryo. And they think it's a slippery slope. So you outlaw embryos, doing anything to embryos. That's your first step. Well, guess what's still on the books in Italy? You can't make an embryo and freeze it, but you can get an abortion, a state-subsidized abortion in Italy. And they said, they think the Catholic Church is going to start with the embryo and then move to the fetus and try to do something about the abortion law. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. You've got abortion laws on the books in many countries, but you can't do ARTs to create the embryo or to freeze the embryo or so on. And this is why there's a lot of legal discussion going on about what should be done, across countries. Yeah?
Yeah, what you are talking about those non-realistic representations on the happy mothers and happy babies,
mm-hmm.
In tourism studies, they talk about this as the concept of world-making.
World-making.
And they, in the sense of tourism studies, it means that they're going to represent tourism destinations as non-realistic. So it would be interesting to confront this with maybe other.
Yeah, it is actually a good term, world making. You know, and I do know we can't kind of completely eliminate the notion of the holiday or the touristic part of this, because some of these clinics really are trying to sort of have these tourism packages. And one of the questions about the exploitation has been that there is suggestion that a lot of Eastern European women are being lured as egg donors or as surrogates by being told that after we harvest your eggs, we're going to put you up in a nice hotel on the beach for 3 days. You know, you're going to get a little vacation after we harvest your eggs, you know. And so there are, you know, the blending of the sort of touristic themes in the world. And sometimes women go through these as cohorts. Like Israeli women end up going to Cyprus, where there are doctors who are bringing Russian eggs to Cyprus to serve the Israeli population that wants to have light-haired gametes. And so we know that this is happening in the country of Cyprus through some very interesting global connections. And the Israeli women are taken over as a little tour group, like a little global gate, you know, whatever, like a little group of women together, and they go, they put them up together in the hotel, and they kind of make a world together. So the notion of world making is really very interesting. And I'm sure they probably do that with the gamete donors too, because when I was in Beirut, these American girls, I mean, Beirut is an unlikely place to go as a young American woman. and they were sending them in little groups of two or three so that they could provide support, and they put them in a hotel, and they told them, we have golf in Beirut, and, you know, trying to entice them. And it was amazing to me how little these women were receiving. They were basically lower-income women from the Midwest. The going rate in the state of Michigan was $2,000 to deliver your eggs, and they were being paid $3,000 to go to Beirut. Expenses paid, you know, but they'd also get $3,000. In Connecticut, where I live now, which is on the East Coast Corridor and, you know, the Ivy Corridor, the Connecticut going rate is $8,000 to provide your eggs. But it is unregulated in the United States, and so there are couples who are searching for these particular egg donors, and there are advertisements. I've heard it can go up to $150,000 that couples are willing to pay for special eggs. And so it's out of control, you know, it's out of control. Unregulated. Time for drinks?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.